Hi, y'all. I'm an alcoholic, and my problem is this. And by God's grace, the gift of fellowship and people like you in rooms like this, I haven't found it necessary. Nor have I had a drink of anything containing alcohol since August the 20th, 1977, and I'm very grateful for that. I'm very grateful to be here. I'm very grateful that you're all here. It would be awful talking to an empty building. But I sure am glad that you're here. And this is about you, and it's about me, and it's about our life. As far as I'm concerned, and I don't ever get any flack about this, one of the few things I say that I don't, but this is one of the most wonderful things that's ever happened to the world today, is Alcoholics Anonymous. Because can you just imagine this bunch that's in here right now driving drunk out here on the streets tonight? It wouldn't be much to do out there, would it? And that's where I'd be if I was, because the alcoholic must see and be seen. Once we take a drink, we want to be seen, we want to see, but most of that we want to be seen. And certainly we want to be heard, and quite naturally. And the longer we drink, the louder we get. And I'm taking my own inventory there. But we've talked about these 12 steps and the 12 tradition, 12 steps and 12 tradition in the 12 and 12 says the 12 steps, a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, when practiced as a way of life, could relieve the compulsion to drink and make the user happily and usefully whole. Of all the promises that we've got in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think that's one of the best. It tells us just exactly that, what these very things are up here. We are not bad people trying to get good. We're sick people trying to get well. And hopefully, and as it generally happens, as we go to getting a little better, and as we go to getting a little bit more serenity and peace of mind, we become better people. I wonder about myself, if I'm as good as I want to be or should be, but I guess it's all right. It's kind of in God's hands. But the fact that when you told me that I had a disease, that helped me as much as anything in the world, because I know what disease is, and I couldn't figure out why I couldn't quit drinking. I heard you in 1971 when I first came to you, and I heard that it was a disease, and I thought you were using a cop-out. And, of course, she didn't come back, so I had to go out and drink in 29 days. And that was the only reason I was there. But Alcoholics Anonymous is phenomenal. You know, it's like a monkey wrench. It fits all sizes of nuts, you know. Everybody can get in, you know. You have never sunk too low that you are not welcomed here. You will always be welcomed here. But you never will get well enough to leave. And the big book kind of is implicit on that. We don't ever get well from the disease alcoholism. And if you have it, or you think you've got it, then you probably have got it, because you wouldn't be here, because there's not many people in here except the Al-Anons that are here, is here just because they wanted to see what we were doing. They didn't. Nobody's walked around out there wondering what we're doing in here. You know, it's driving by out there right now. I wonder what they're doing in that building. If they're alcoholics, they know. You know, they have an AA group, AA meeting. But once the alcoholic comes to the realization and the total belief and the total honesty and acceptance that he or she must have in that first step and the rest of the 11 steps, with the open-mindedness and the willing that the first three steps include, until we do that, we are not going to have much success at this. And just the disease factor is so much to take care of. Because if I could have quit drinking, I didn't want to be the way I was the last 12 years that I drank. Out of the 20-some-odd years I drank, or 25 years that I drank, I assure you that I didn't want to be the way I was the last 12 years. And nobody else wanted to be that way either. And, it was a majority vote. Because the fact is, I work both sides of the street when I drink alcohol, and most of us do. But once we take that first step, and I like to talk about taking the steps. I don't particularly care about working the steps. Alcoholics we don't really like that four-letter word, work. And it turned me off too when I first got here, because I thought it meant I was going to have to do something and slave about it or work about it. And you do have to do something. You have to put forth a lot of action in this, because without action, nothing happens. But we have to take these 12 steps and take them and put them in our life as a way of life, because we have to change. We must change the person that came in that door. And of our own accord, it tells us up there in the first step. And that serenity prayer that we say at every meeting tells us we can't change ourselves. There's no way I could change me. If I could have, I would have done it. When the man told me that night when I got out of Terrell State Hospital that I needed to change, I had no idea what he was talking about. I had no idea what I had to do. I wanted to change. I didn't want to be like I was, and I didn't seem to have any choice. And people say, well, why do you keep drinking? You've been pronounced dead twice. Well, it won't happen anymore. because I'll always just drink a little, you know, and I don't know. I never figured out how come I was just going to have two drinks and about a half a gallon. I just never did figure that out. That was a very strange thing to me. It doesn't today, because I know I was lying to myself when I said I was just going to have a drink. Because, it wasn't drinking and drunkenness was not synonymous with me at that time. I remember when we'd have some people come and talk while I was in the Terrell State Hospital, and this one guy, in fact, I spoke at his group Saturday night. He came up, I heard him talk twice, and he'd tell us, "I haven't had a drink since so-and-so and so-and-so." And I was sitting in the back there thinking, yeah, what do you mean you have? I'll guarantee he's going to drink three beers on the way home tonight or four. I didn't realize that once the alcoholic took the first drink, I'm going to get drunk. The big book says that men and women drink alcohol essentially because they like the way it affects us. It affects us. If it don't do anything for you, it ain't going to do nothing to you. And it done a whole lot to the alcoholics in this room, and it done a whole lot to us too, because it was my way of hiding from life and not looking reality square in the face. And that's exactly opposite from what this is all about. This is life, and it's looking it right dead in the face and knowing that you can do it. And that comes after a few months here. And to some, it comes after a few months. Some, it may take a few years, but it's well worth the effort, how long it takes. Once we get to that second step, it's the open-mindedness about this whole thing, that I had to become honest with myself and I had to become open-minded with myself. Open-minded about everything in AA, because you might be right and I might be wrong. And I needed to, today's just as important. I've talked so much about that sign that's in my living room that says it's what you learn after you think you know it all that's important. And that was where I was at. And I read it at that first meeting I was at. And I didn't know it wasn't AA, but I looked at it and I've thought about it a many a time. It's what you learn after you think you know it all that's important. And that's as true today as it was that first day I came to AA. The very first time I came, I had 27 days of dry time, or I don't know what you'd call them, but they were restless, irritable, and discontent days, because I had nothing between me and life and me and alcohol. And so I had to find something, and I had to find a way to change. And that's where this all started, was right with the change. The alcoholic must change what he or she is doing. And we can't do that overnight. This is not an overnight program. This is a day-at-a-time program. And we do it one day at a time. And little by little, we'll get better if we keep putting a lot of effort in it. A lot of vigilance goes into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want you people, young people that are new here, to know that. You need to be vigilant about it. Because nothing less will keep you from drinking again. Because the vigilance that I've put in, they used to tell us if you put in 10% as much work on the 12 steps and on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's all the Alcoholics Anonymous program is works. Sometimes we get activities mixed up with action. Sometimes we get fellowship mixed up with program. This is the program. The activities are wonderful, but the action must come from individually. Nobody out there can do it for me, and I can't do it for anybody. But once the second step came and it presented that open-mindedness to me, that I needed to be open-minded, that you might be right and I might be wrong. And then the third step, I didn't like it all, as you all know, and I took a long time before I took that third step, really. And when I'm talking about a long time, I'm talking about several weeks of going to meetings and every night and every time I got a chance. I feel like that's the second. And there's about four things that run a real close thing to being first for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. One is that the 12 steps have to be taken in my life on a daily basis. The second thing is that I must have a sponsor that I will listen to and do what he says. And I must make a lot of meetings. My first sponsor gave me basically those four tenets when he said he had rules for me. It was to give up, and let's start putting the 12 steps in your life. Every morning, you surrender so you can win. Every morning, he said, give up. He said, grow up. He said, show up and shut up. Well, I've worked three of those. I have tried to participate in three of those, and I won't dare tell you what the one is I haven't done yet. This is for people that's living on a basis of unsatisfied demands. We are constantly wanting more out of people than they'll give us, and we expect more and we demand more, and it becomes a total unsatisfied demands. I had them incessantly to wives and to everyone else. The fourth step we talked about last week, we made a searching and fearless inventory of ourselves. We looked at what is our causes and conditions. We had to get down to why we drink alcohol. Because just like we said last week, if drinking is my problem, then quitting is my answer. So I quit drinking. How come I'm still a mess? How come them 27 days before I got to you people, how come I was restless, irritable, and discontent? Murder crossed my mind several times, and this is not bragging, or this is not being cute. And I was at the end of that other message, was that it was going to be something. I had to do something. I had to take a step, or take my life, or take a drink of alcohol, and those two are synonymous. For us, if you've been here very long, or if you hadn't been here very long, the next one could be the last one. And you don't have to, I don't have to worry about that if I don't take the first one. But taking that inventory is so terribly important, because each one of these 12 steps are linked as a chain with 12 links in them. One comes right behind the other. After we make a decision, turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood Him in step 3. Step 4 is trying to find out what our will and life is all about. Step 5 is talking to God and to another person and ourselves. This is me on that sheet of paper. I had to realize that. I had written down Les Williams right there on that sheet of paper about my first inventory and my last one too, all the inventories in between. That's who I really am, and I must accept that as that's me. Because I didn't know who I was when I got here, and you didn't either. You might think you did, but you didn't. You were so invaded by alcohol and the disease alcoholism that you really didn't know who you really were. You thought you did. But along about this time, when you do it, when you take that fifth step, And you put it down on paper, you've got it down on paper, and then you talk to your sponsor about it, or whomever you choose. It says preacher and other stuff in the big book, but at that time there wasn't sponsorship, and they hadn't started, nobody had talked about sponsorship yet, so the word wasn't in the big book. It became very prominent in 52 when Bill wrote the 12 and 12. But when we get to that fifth step and we look at that, then the second thing that my sponsor told me had to start happening, he said, give up, grow up. Well, I gave up this morning when I got up. I put the first 3 steps in my life. I got up. And if I've got the same state of mind when I leave here and go home tonight, I will tell him, thank you for a good day. Because it's been a good day. It don't matter what's happened to me. It has been a good day if I hadn't had a drink of alcohol. Because without a drink of alcohol, I've got a chance to do anything I want to do, be anything I want to be, and go anywhere I want to go. You can too. The same thing happens for you. There is no exception. But if I take a drink, all bets are off. It's over. Because that's it. I would never make it back. And because I know I can get drunk again, but I don't think I could ever sober up again. And I don't have to worry about that. It's the one day at a time situation is very fine with me, and I like that. But when we get to step 6, we became willing, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And this is a daily step. This is something we do every day that we need to do and put in our lives to take care of the character defects that we have had the past 24 hours, or the things that are bothering us the most, the things that have kept her, if it be resentments, it's a resentment you need to get that tended to immediately. We'll talk at length about this next week in the 10th step, because the 10th step takes care of this daily living and the things we do in the daily living. But once we become entirely willing to have God remove all of these defects of character, never say never. Don't ever say you won't be rid of lust. Or don't ever say you won't be rid of anger. And yes, I told y'all that if I talked about anger enough last week, I would get angry this next week. I haven't been angry a long time until one day this week, and somebody licked all the red off of my candy early Wednesday morning. And it stayed that way for the whole day. And I mean, I knew I could stop it, but I enjoyed being mad. Because I didn't like the sucker anyhow, if you want to know the truth. I didn't say anything to him, but on the inside, I wanted to tell him a lot of stuff. And I paid for it, too. I paid dearly for it in the fact that I had an emotional hangover from it. For 2 or 3 days, I was lethargic. I just didn't want to do anything. And it was an emotional hangover from being such an idiot, you know. And it never showed. I mean, it probably did if you was looking at me, but you didn't see it. But I felt it. And I knew how I felt it. And I really, all the way home that afternoon, I prayed to God that I didn't call the man the next morning and tell him what a sorry so-and-so he was. Because I didn't say anything to let him denote that it was. That I had done it, but I had done it to me, and I'm the one that needed to do it. But once we get to step 7, this step, when Bill wrote this step in December the 18th, 1938, and he was writing that chapter, How It Works, and he wrote these 12 steps, and he got to this one here. It said, down on our knees, we humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Well, the 43 people, 42 people that were sober at that time didn't like that down on their knees business. Because that's what they used to do. It tells you that they go that the man, that's before we had many women, that they would take you upstairs in this house, Clarence and Williams' house, where they were meeting in New York, and they would take the man up there, and they'd tell him a little his story and make him get down on his knees and pray until he got it. And then we'd take him down, and Bill thought we needed to get down on your knees. You know, I've told this story, I told it the week before last, but God loves to hear strange voices. That's just simple. So, the fact is, and he don't care what position you're in. He don't care if you're in an airplane, rowboat, down on your knees, where you're at. Everybody does it the way they need to do it. But they need to really do it. I learned how to pray in my car, and I still pray a great deal in my car. I pray a lot of other places, but I pray a lot I pray a lot in my car. And that's where I learned how to pray, and learned how to pray right. But humbly, this is something that I made fun about last week. Didn't make fun of it. I made fun of what my sponsor always tells me when he knows I'm going off to talk somewhere. He asks me how many people is there, if it's at a convention, and I tell him 750. He said, "Well, I don't guess that's enough for you to talk about humility, is it?" I said, "No, I've got to be 1,500. No, I've got to be." it's a joke, because humility to me is like gratitude. We can have a meeting at my home group tomorrow night, and I can make tears come to your eyes telling you how wonderful, how grateful I am, and everything in the world. But you don't have to do that. I don't have to tell you nothing. It's like humility. Humility and humbleness become, you can see it. You know I am or you know I'm not. And rarely will you ever see me when I am, because it's not a product that I have a lot. Because most alcoholics, humility is one of the far-reaching words that we don't really understand. I didn't understand it either until I got to the seventh step. And when I got to it, I got to humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Well, I knew what my shortcomings were. Most all those seven deadly sins at one time or the other that we talked about last week in the 12 and 12. But I called a guy and asked him, right here in this town, asked him, what do you think of, give me your definition of humility. He said, "Well, humility is great." He said, that means never having to be first in line. And I thought, I never have eaten at cafeterias for that reason. There's always been a lot of people off, and I don't like for people to pass me on the highway, Then I called a guy, a friend of mine up in North Carolina, and asked him, and he said, "Oh, that's very good." So humility means thinking less about yourself instead of less of yourself. Thinking less about yourself instead of less of yourself. And I didn't particularly care for that, And then one night we were in what was then my home group, and there had been a woman moved down here from another state, way up east, from New York, as a matter of fact. And we were having a seven-step meeting, and all of us kind of pontificated on what we thought humility was, And as it come time for her, she said, humility comes from the Latin word humus, which means earth, get down to earth. And I thought, my God, she's brilliant. This is a smart woman here. So I married her. I really like to say, and that's all she knew about AA, but that's a lie, because she is very much a good, she's a year younger than me and got a year longer sobriety. She's 16 years younger than I am, got a year longer sobriety than I have. She sobered up in New York when she was 25 years old. And she's got a whale of a program, and it's not because I'm her husband. You just got to say that. But I didn't, if you want to hide something from the alcoholic, every Al-Anon knows, put it in the big book, and they'll never find it, because that's where last place we're going to look. Well, true to form, I was got all these great and wonderful definitions of humility, and all of a sudden, I was reading the 12 and 12, and on bottom page 73 in the old 12 and 12, it says, "The basic ingredient of all humility is a desire to seek and do God's will." Just that simple. Here's where the alcoholic objectives start getting wider and wider. Once we humble ourselves enough to say, "I can't do this, that I can't change myself, that I can't make my defects of character go away. I can't help. I got to do something about my resentments and my fears. And I can't do nothing about that. I'm powerless." I said in the first step, I'm powerless over people. I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless over people, places, and things. I'm just powerless. And when we get down here, this is the total admittance that I am powerless. I'm powerless. And so I humbly ask him. I talk to him like he was God and I'm less. He's management, I'm labor, as we know. But, this is where we start finding our true purpose in life. That's where, as we talked last week about those horizons, how mine had gotten down so terribly narrow when I couldn't go anywhere but to the bootlegger and to the liquor store and back to my place. And that was just about my horizons. And the longer we... And self-centeredness, as self-centered as alcoholics are, we're not going to overdo this. We're not going to overcome this in a day or a week or a year or in a lifetime. This is something that cannot be turned around. And we didn't get sick in a day and we're not getting well in a day. And just because I've been sober nearly 26 years, I drank 25 years, that doesn't mean that because I got a few more months than I had years a long time ago, doesn't mean that that I've gotten well yet. I've gotten better. And it's a daily, one little bitty step at a time, you know. Humility is, it creates faith that can meet any emergency. Because that if we're praying for God's will for us and the power to carry that out, once we do that, and once we put the seventh step in our, and we in the seventh step, it's just got one little paragraph, but it talks about removing all of our defects of character, so we take them away. And I enumerate mine as I go along when I'm talking to God every morning or every middle of the day or whenever it is. I talk to Him the second or third time that day after I've messed up it the second and third time. And I talk to Him about the defects of character that caused whatever it was. And ask Him to remove it and ask Him to take it from me. And it's generally gone for a while. Maybe gone like that anger was for a long time. But it comes back because I allow it to. You know, we talked about the serenity. And with this, just a little bit of willingness and humility gives us a great deal of serenity and peace of mind. And I didn't know what that was. We talked about that last week. The emotions that we have in here, this is a disease of the emotions, and I just never had much serenity, and I never had much peace. I didn't have any peace of mind. I had nothing that I could tell what it really was, because I numbed it up so much with alcohol that I didn't feel like that it could do any good. But once I took this seventh step and put it right in class with that sixth step on a day-to-day basis, my life started gradually doing what you said it would. It started changing. It had already changed up in step one when I first became hopeful. When people like you in rooms like this gave me hope. But it became more so, and it had grown. It had grown, and I was believing more, and I was questioning less, and I was trying to do this thing the way it said do. And it got to where I wasn't really afraid of not getting something I really wanted, because you see. I recommend this to the people I sponsor. I don't make them do it. I don't say you ought to. I just recommend it because it worked for me twice in 2 years. When I first came here, a man told me to write down my name on a postcard and put 1 through 12 on it. And on the first thing you write in big letters is sobriety. Now you got that. And then put down whatever else you want on those next 11 places. Fold that card up and give it to somebody or hide it from yourself. And keep it for a year. Then come back and open it. And if you've kept that sobriety first, you probably won't have those 11. You probably 9 of them you wouldn't have. And the other 2 that you did get, it's not really that important to you. Because I was always afraid. My 12 and 12 says right in the front page of it, where I wrote coming, I think I was coming to Tyler that night. I don't know, but I was going to an AA meeting. And I stopped right out 3 miles outside of my business and wrote down, I don't want to turn my will and life over to the care of God. Because He may not do it the way I want it done. And in step 7, that started to reverse itself. Because all of a sudden, I wasn't worried about if I lost something. Wasn't worried about what I was going to get. That's called turning it over to God. And like we said last week, turning it over to God don't mean digging up a seed every few minutes to see if it's germinating. You leave it alone and let it be. And then that's what the seventh step is always about. But step 7, I started to really feel like that there was a lot of hope that, yes, I may be able to stay sober. Yeah, this looks like it's going to work because I got all kind of, it wasn't a spiritual awakening, but I got all kind of a feeling that I can do this thing. Yes, I can do this thing. And about that time after I had done that and found out for sure I was going to have to do it every day or needed to, I was beginning to learn to live sober. First night I was here, I told you, it didn't take me long to learn how to get drunk or how to live drunk. Just turn the sucker up. It'll be taken care of for you for sure, because you're going to make a mess and you're going to mess up your life and a lot of other people's. So, but I didn't know how to live sober. It'd been a long time since I'd been sober, and I didn't live too. Then I was restless, irritable, and discontent until I took that first drink way back when I was 16. Well, nearly 16. I was closer to 16 than I was anything else. But when we get to here, when we get to step 7, and we do this on a daily basis, then there's time for us to get started with what we talked about last week. Getting right, we talked last week about what I thought. And you won't find it in any book. This is just Les Williams. The fact is that this whole program is about 4 things. Getting right with God, getting right with me, getting right with you, and keeping it that way on a daily basis. Me and you and God, that's all there is. And I was at odds with all 3 of them Well, I was at odds with me, I was at odds with God, and I was at odds with most of my fellow men, because nobody didn't want to be around here. And we around me when I was drinking. And when you found me drinking, it was a red letter day, because I either was headed after some, didn't have none, or was fixing to have somebody to bring me some. It was on its way to my house, one way or the other. But this deals with our the relationship with other people. And here's where people start saying, don't. I'm never going to do this. No, don't do that. No, don't close your mind to this, because don't say you won't do something, because you start closing your mind to everything there is up here on this board that you have taken over again when you say, no, I won't do this. The eighth step to me in the 12 and 12 is the best reading we've got in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not trying to put down the big book at all, but the eighth step gave me more information. It gave me more information about what I was looking at and what I was trying to do. Because this is not about making amends. This has nothing to do with nearly with making amends. It says we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. That's what we're doing here. We're making a list. Most of it's going to come out of that fourth step. Out of that fourth step, we're going to start to the people we were resentful of, the people we had harmed, the people we had hurt, and everything that we've got. And that's we've got to do that. I get a lot of flack about what I'm fixing to say, but I still maintain that the book says it, and it sure does. When you take this first eighth step, and when you take your last eighth step, the person that needs to be on the first of the list is you. Because if you don't forgive yourself for what you've done, you'll roll around in that morass called alcoholism. And if you don't forgive yourself, we're fixing to get ready, and I'm going to go out and ask a lot of mother-in-laws to please forgive me. And that ain't an easy deal, you know. I mean, I tried to stay on eight for a whole lifetime, you know. So that way I didn't have to go do that. But this is not about, this is about getting ready. It takes a lot of preparation for the alcoholic to get ready to do this eighth step. Because this is, it says in there, the reason we drink. That our inability to get along with other people, it was immediate cause of all of our woes, including our alcoholism. I couldn't get along with you. Better still, you couldn't get along with me. My shelf life at any place I went was very short. I mean, I didn't have a shelf life, hardly at some places. And because I was told to leave a lot of places in no uncertain terms and not to come back in many more certain terms. But this is where we start dealing with everyone, not just the people we love, not just the people that are easy to make amends to. But this is the people, we set them down, we write them down, and we write them down in however order you want to. But I get the worst ones first and get rid of them, off of it. But you see, this is done with a sponsor in mind. Because with a sponsor in mind, we've got to realize that we've got to take another inventory here. And he don't say that. No, no. He says three times in the 12 and 12 here, we take a survey of our lives and how it affected other people. Well, a survey is an inventory. You can't go to somebody. You're getting ready to go out and make an apology to your worst enemies, the people that you know they done you harm, and perhaps you done them a little harm, so you're just going to go tell them. Well, you better be able to do it the right way, because let me tell you something. I went to a guy one time, and there's some people in this room know you don't know who I'm talking about, but I know you know him, and I went to him and told him. I said, you know, I really done you some harm while I was drinking. And he said, yeah. I said, well, I'd like to make amends for that. He said, well, that's fine. I hope you keep doing what's fine. And I said, you know, you were a pretty good bastard yourself. And I mean, I just went ahead and told him what I really. And, you know, he didn't forgive me. And I didn't, you know, I had to go do that again. And you talking about eating crow twice. That ain't right. I mean, this is where we start eating that crow. But still, I had to get ready. See, all of the mistakes I made become available to me with sponsorship. Because Jack and I would take each person. And we would talk about this person. Of course, my mother-in-law and father-in-law, I didn't have enough paper to put them all down. That way, I'd put them mother-in-law and father-in-law number one. And just old number one, two, three, four, and whatever. And so the fact was that, I talked to a guy today that knew me back yonder before I started drinking. And he called me about something, and we were talking, and he said, I saw you with another woman the other day. I said, really? Who was it? He said, she was a tall blonde. I said, yeah, it's my wife. He said, no, it's not, because you had a short brunette when you was living here. When I knew you, I said, oh, well, there were several in between that. He said, why? I said, you don't need to know. This is where we start clearing away the wreckage of the past, our human relationships. And very easy to go to the ones we love and the ones that we're friends with and our best buddies very easy. But those people that you've really done harm to, and that you don't like, it takes a little bit. That's why we do them one at a time. I really thought when I got sober and I read these two steps, number 8 and 9, I thought, you know, maybe I can just build one big monument out at the graveyard where I'm going to be buried and just say I'm sorry. Kind of a blanket deal, you know. And then you couldn't get them all in one room together. So how am I going to do this? We're going to do it one day at a time. And before you get ready, you need to talk about what you did to him, not what he or she done to you. Doesn't matter. It's what your part of this was. We've got to find out what that part is, because we're fixing to go talk to a mother-in-law and a father-in-law. And I was well received by several of them, most of them. I mean, you know, and they. We'll talk about that in a minute when we get to the ninth step. But this is when we do this, we got to realize that we're not the only sick people in the world. And let me tell you something: all you people that are in love with an alcoholic, that are married to an alcoholic, or living with an alcoholic, both of you are alcoholics. The thing you got to remember: there's two sick people in that house, not just you. Because I go to looking at old what's-her-name, and I say, why is she making such a fool out of herself? What's the matter with her? And I go to thinking she's an alcoholic, for God's sakes. I ain't the only sick one in our house, you know. I mean, but you got to remember it's a two-way street. If you're in love with one, or if you're living with one, or so married to one. But we've got to remember that we're trying to get better and not change them. My wife and I have got a good marriage simply because we don't mess with each other's program unless the other one asks us to. And we've both got sponsors, and we both use sponsors. And she'll tell me every night, I'm going to call Jim. I said, the phone's hanging on the wall. And she's saying it playfully. But I know that I've got to review a few minutes and remember what I just did or said. Because I know I've messed up pretty good. But we don't ever try to really attend anybody else, any of my business is mine and her business is hers, and that's the way we handle it. But once we put that down, we realize ourselves, and we start making amends to ourselves. Before we get to the ninth step, remember that we have turned it over to God, and in the big book it says, in the fifth step, this is fixing to be taken away. In other words, if you're going to talk to God about it, and you're another human being in yourself, and you've become honest, and that's what admit means. In 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. That means that we've become honest enough to say, this is really me right here on the paper. And you start looking at who you really are. And you know who you start living the way who you truly are. And that means your actions have changed just a little bit. And they change a little bit more as you go along. But there's a lot of kinds of harm. There's not physical harm. We all know about that. And of course, we always talk about monetarily harm. You know, I've done a lot of people a lot of harm monetarily. A lot of people, especially my mom and dad. And emotional, you know, and spiritual. I gave my mother and daddy such a bad time with staying drunk all the time. And daddy was elder in the church. And all the things that I did that wasn't too promising to make me look better. And him, you know, they had bound to have a terrible, terrible, terrible spiritual and mental thing. But I believe once I've said I'm sorry, I believe that's enough. Because I believe I need to learn how to deal with it unless I make the same mistake over and then I can say I'm sorry again. Most folks are tired of hearing us say we're sorry. We've said it so much. And so, you know, I put my mother and daddy, of course, was right on the top of the list. And I had them on the list long before I ever got to the ninth step, because I'd already made amends to them. Then I had to start carrying that out the survey that I made of myself. I had blamed them for everything. And I had to start, that survey told me what my part of that deal was. And my deal was, I was just didn't like to work. And I couldn't understand why I never had a lot of money. And they had money. And I wanted to know about that. And it was the fact is, they worked, they didn't hang around in bars, and they didn't get married every 15 minutes. That's just to say a few things, you know. But when we start praying, we take them one at a time with the sponsor's help, and as we get on down through them, we're already into the ninth step by the time we're starting through with them. But sometimes I have to pray to be willing to be willing. I have to pray for willingness, and finally it'll come. And when it does, it will come. And that list comes in very handy. And once you cross one off, it's a done deal, unless you do it the way I did. And if you done it the way I did with that guy, you got to go back and do it again in deuces this time. But step nine is the reason I'm standing behind this podium tonight, or any night, or the reason I was able to get up this morning and not take a drink, with the help of these other staffs, but this one right here made me know. And I've never told the first story I'm going to tell about the ninth step, but it said we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would harm them or others. I can't get my sobriety at somebody else's expense. I can't go up and tell some old dude that I used to go with your wife when I was drinking, sure I'm sorry. Now, that ain't God. First of all, I'm others. He could hurt me. And the second of all is, that would hurt her and him. And if he don't, it would do nobody no good at all. I have to be just a little bit careful about what I'm doing here in this ninth step, because I don't want to say something that'll hurt him. But the first time I remember in my last marriage before this marriage, that had quit on January the 12th, 1977. And this was that I'd been sober, I don't know, 2 or 3 months. And I was paying child support for a little girl that we had had. And one Monday, I called her and asked her, could I come to come out of the office and at a certain time, and I would just hand her money so she wouldn't have to go, she wouldn't have to wait on it. She said, yeah, I really need the money right now. So I drove up there, and the little lady opened my car door. And that was a bunch of AA literature. She slammed that door and walked around and told me, I took the money and just turned around and looked and called me one of her favorite names and questioned my ancestry. And she walked off, And I've thought about that story a lot, She died at the age of 45 with a disease called alcoholism. But I hadn't made my amends to her yet at that time, because I hadn't got to her. We talk about my ninth step, and I tell you it's the reason I'm here, and it really is, because when I first got here, when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, or right before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd been married to the same woman 3 times, and that just counts as one, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, she's not listed in the whole area. She was number 1, 2, and 3, all big one. We had 2 children, my oldest child was my daughter, and her name was Lisa. And Lisa and I were just big buds. We were dubs all the way, even with all my drinking. And me and her mother got divorced the first time. Lisa and I still big buds. Got divorced. After the last time, she had seen me a few weeks later out with a woman in Dallas. And my daughter is a real Christian gal. She is very much a Christian, has been ever since she was born. I mean, she's really too good for her own good, I think. But, you got to do what you got to do. But I'm certainly not making fun of religion, but now she is really a good old gal. And my daughter asked me on the telephone. I could tell she was mad that Saturday morning. And I said, what's the matter? She said, I want to ask you a question. Are you going to marry that blonde-headed so-and-so you were with last night? I said, well, I don't know. At least I may. I probably will. Why? She said, well, I hope you drop dead, you bastard, you. And she hung up the phone. And I said, I was heavy drinking. And I mean, I was really heavy drinking. And I drank. Every time I needed an excuse to drink, that was all I had to think about. Well, look how Lisa's done me. Look how Lisa's done me. All these things. And it was always about Lisa. But when we got down to Lisa on my amends list, after all the others, my sponsor said, just skip that one. And what? That's my daughter. Yeah, I know who she is. I know her. I've met her. She's been with you in my bank a jillion times. I said, well, I need to make amends with her. He said, yeah, I agree. You do. But said, it ain't going to come now. He said, I don't know when it will come, but God will tell you. He said, you've got to trust God akin to this. He won't make amends for you, but he'll tell you when it's time. Well, time went on. A year passed. And every time I'd see Jack, about every 90 days, when I one of the many times in the month I would see him in those 3 months, I'd say, Jack, what about Lisa? What about Lisa? He'd say, has God told you yet? Well, no, I didn't hear him saying a word. He said, well, I said, you'll know. You just keep on. If you'll keep on doing what you're doing, going to all the meetings, taking the 12 steps and taking them in your life and use them as a way of life, and you keep doing the things that you're doing, God will see you. You got to just listen. That's okay. Well, long, 2 years and 4 months passed. No from Lisa. I'm nearly through with all the rest of my amends. And by the way, well, we'll go ahead and finish this. Anyhow, Lisa, one Sunday at noon, she called me and said, Daddy. And I said, what? She said, how would you like to come and see your granddaughter that was born 3 days ago? I couldn't even answer it. I started crying so hard. I cried, and it wasn't tears of sorrow. it was tears of happiness. I saw my life really changing. I saw me getting some things. I had liked the feelings I had got from all the rest of the steps, because there's a freedom behind every step we do. It's a freedom behind every one of them. But this one here, that really did. Now, my daughter, as I told her, she married a guy that had all the money there was, and now she's married to a pro golfer. So they had gotten a divorce. But her first wife was, her first husband was well-to-do out of Kansas City. They had lots of money, big money, I guess, because they lived good and lived well and had a home. But I didn't know where it was at. And I said, well, give me your address, and I'd like to come see her tomorrow, after I finally quit crying long enough. And so I went over the next morning and finally found it, and with the help of a policeman telling me where it was at. But I got to the house, and it was humongous, a huge house. And the swimming pool and the big, all of the stuff with the heater in it and everything. And I just parked my car and walked across the driveway, you know, and walked up to her doorbell and rang it. And I found out that morning that my God's got a sense of humor. Because when the door opened, there stood old wife number 1, 2, and 3 looking me right in the eye. And I said, God, this ain't funny. I think God laughs at us a lot. I really do. I think he gets his kicks out of us because, the way we act and the way we do. But as was her way of doing, she invited me in and asked, said, how are you doing? We hugged. She took off and went. She said, I know you want to see my grandchild. I said, no, I want to see my grandchild. And I thought, oh, here we go again. She was just kidding. I was just kidding. And she left, went on to the back of the house somewhere. And me and Lisa went and looked and played with the baby a while. And then we sat down and we talked. We just talked about everything except my alcoholism. Finally, when we got ready to go, started out the door, I just put my arms around her in the middle of her den and said, Lisa, I've got some amends I need to make to you. She said, no, you don't need to make no amends to me. You made your amends to me when you walked across my front yard sober. I said, you haven't had a drink since the 20th of August, 1977. And I cried the rest of that day until I got to Jack's Bank. And when I got to Jack's Bank, I walked in and he had a customer in his office. And I said, I want to talk to you a minute. He said, well, I think you do. I said, go back in the director's room, get you a cup of coffee, and I'll be back there in a few minutes. Well, I was back there pacing the floor because I was so mad at him. I was ready to kill him. And he said, what in the hell is the matter with you? I said, I've just come back from making, because see, I'd see Jack all the time. And I said, I'm going to go to Lisa. No, you're not going to make, God, okay, y'all, no. But he said, you did? I said, yeah. He said, why didn't you call me before you done it? I said, because you said no. You probably said no. He said, well, how did you know to go do it? I said, she called me. He said, well, that's a pretty good indication that God told her to, don't you think? Whatever, you know. And I said, well, you know, Jack, I've never felt this good in my whole life. Never in my whole life do I feel as good about me and as good about something as I do me and AA and everything. And you've denied me this for 2 years and 4 months. He said, no, I hadn't. No, uh-uh. He said, Les, how many times did you tell Lisa that you would never take another drink and be drunk by noon? How many times did you ever tell her you wouldn't get in jail no more and be there by the weekend? How many times did you promise her all this stuff and none of it ever came true? He said, I bet you didn't tell her a while ago that she was, that you were never going to drink, did you? I said, no, I never told her that. I can't tell nobody that. She said, that's right. He said, that's right. He said, I wanted you to be sure that you had a good enough track record, that you had something to bring with you to show. And said, she knew your sobriety date as well as you did. And she hadn't spoken to you in all those years. And I knew then that this program was the most powerful thing I'd ever had a hold of. But it became to the two things that were so much important. My sponsor told me to do something, and I did it. And I didn't like it, but I did it anyhow. And like I say, they ain't all been that good, because Lisa and I are real close today. I mean, we're real close. She lives out in Aledo, and like I say, she's married to a pro golfer, and they've got a great home, and they've got a great Christian life, and I've got another grandbaby now, but that's neither here nor there. A little later on, probably 5 years after that, they moved. And the husband she's got now, she had been divorced, and I guess it was about 7 years. And I called her one day, and we called each other all the time then, and she lived in Corpus Christi, and I called her back in November, and I said, hey, I'm going to come to Corpus in February and talk at a convention down there. She said, good, I'll come hear you. I said, no, you won't. I said, don't you ever come hear me. Don't you ever buy a tape of me, because I've hurt you enough, and I don't want to ever hurt you anymore. She said, well, that makes good sense, but when are we going to go to dinner? I said, we'll go to dinner when I get through. She said, okay, where will we go? I said, right at the hotel there. There's a big, nice restaurant right across the street. She said, yeah, I remember that restaurant. She said, well, we'll see you there at what time? I said, let's make it about a quarter of 10, maybe 10. She said, okay. I went over and we was eating, and a bunch of, I don't remember, I think it's 1,300 there, but it was a lot of people. And a bunch of them was coming to that restaurant, and they'd come by, and I'd talk to them, and I'd show them my new grandbaby, and my other granddaughter was there with her, and my new son-in-law of about 2.5 years. Everybody, you know, everything was fine. We had a great time. And when we got ready to leave, I said, hey, walk over to the hotel with me. Y'all come on over. I've got to go upstairs and get a present that my wife sent you that she was having made, and it just got made. See, my wife and my daughter, they're real good friends. They're damn near the same age. I mean, they ain't a whole lot different. But I went upstairs in the atrium in the hotel. It was full. And I was riding one of those inside elevators, as glass. And I looked down. I was up on the 7th floor. And I looked down when we stopped. And I looked, and there's my daughter, my two granddaughters, and my son-in-law, and a bunch of y'all was hanging around them, shaking their hands and talking to them and everything. And I didn't think anything about it. And nobody else did either. I came back down. There's still a bunch of people talking to them. And I walked them out to the car, because they had to get up early and go to church that next morning. I walked them to the car. And I didn't think any more about it until the next Thursday. And I got a letter. And I know I can't keep from telling this without crying, because she told me, the first line said, I love my dad. But better than that, I love the people that he deals with. Said, I'd give anything that I've got if my church was as friendly as your bunch. And they went, and she went on and on and on. She even went and got her big book and read it, so she'd know what her daddy does. She won't listen to my tapes because I won't let her. She don't need to. But she was still at the end of the letter praising what kind of people y'all are, telling me what kind of people y'all were, and wished that their church was that away. And so, you know, that made everything all right. And every time I get low and think, well, it just ain't, I don't know, I believe I'll read Lisa's letter. And when I do, I get up. And I was having this affair with this married woman, and I was trying to be real nice about it, but I was having an affair with her, and she was well-to-do, she was very rich, and we would generally meet once or twice a week, at least once a week, and every time I'd get out of the car, she would give me some money. Every time, you know, I mean, 50 here, 600, I remember one 600. But I borrowed that. I mean, I just mentioned that I need it. She gave it to me. And I just, you know, and so I didn't think much about it, you know. I didn't, you know. But when I got sober, she was way down on my list. And I went to her house one day. Her husband's gone to work. And I told her, I said, I come here for one reason. And that was to tell you that if I ever hurt you, I'm really sorry. She said, God, I've heard you were getting better. And said, you are better. Said, you look better. You're doing better. That's wonderful. And I left, and that was it. Until about 2 or 3 years later. The only people that knew her, that only one person knew about mine and her little deal, was a friend of mine. And he called me and said, you read the paper today? And I said, no. He said, get the obituaries when you get caught up and read them. I think you'll find it interesting. And I read it, and I found her husband's name in it. And I debated about what to do about sending her, you know, a sympathy card or not. And I thought, no, she'll have to explain that to her kids. Not no need. So I didn't. And I mean, my life just rolled right along. And one Thursday afternoon, about 6 weeks later, she called me and said, how are you doing? I said, I'm fine. She said, are you busy? I said, yeah, sure am. She said, well, you know, you and I need to talk about this money you owe me. And I said, what money? And then I realized there were some people around. I said, yeah, I guess we do. But I can't talk about it now because I'm busy. How about I call you Monday morning? She said, okay. Well, just, I mean, I was mad the rest of that day. I could have chewed up nails and spit out tacks all to her. And all of a sudden, I got closed up, and I didn't even start cleaning up. I didn't start doing anything but picking up the phone, calling my sponsor, and telling him what an idiot she was. He said, yeah? I said, yeah. She wants me to pay back some money. He said, well, do you owe it? I said, no, I don't owe it. He said, well, then don't pay her back. But I wish you'd pray about it tonight. Pray about it for a while, and, you know, we'll talk later. I said, okay. Last Thursday night, I prayed. Friday, I prayed a little, and then Friday night, and then Saturday. And about Saturday afternoon, I come to realize, you know, I may owe that old gal a little money. Can't be all that much. So I told my wife about it. She said, I don't care. She said, I ain't paying none of it. I said, well, I don't know. She takes long steps to keep wearing out her shoes, I'm going to tell you. But she said, I said, no. She said, it's not my amends. I said, no, I'm just telling you. I just want you to know. She said, okay. So I called her on Monday morning. Now, let me tell you a little story. If you want to find out about the history of AA, of course, it's always good to read AA Comes of Age. But if you want to get the real scoop, read Lois Remembers. Because Lois wasn't drunk all the time. This woman wasn't drunk all the time, and this guy was. And I asked her how much money I owed her. And she gave me an astronomical figure, and I couldn't say zero. I just kind of got my breath and kind of controlled myself, and I said, I haven't got that much money. She said, I know that. She said, you can pay me out. Pay me by the week, by the month. I said, well, why don't we just let me do it every week? She said, okay. And we got a rent figure. For years and years and years and years, I was sending that money off every Monday morning. Well, one Sunday, I was figuring up, hey, I can pay her off a year right now. I've got it right now. I can pay it all by the year right now and get rid of her. And on the next morning when I got up, I just sent her one payment. I sent her 52 more payments. You know why? I ain't done much good in my whole life. And it felt so damn good to do something good that I wanted it to last, and so I got me 52 more weeks out of it. She didn't need the money. I knew that all along. But she wasn't the one that's going to get drunk if I didn't pay her. I knew I was going to get drunk if I didn't pay her. And she died here a couple of years ago. And I didn't send any sympathy card or anything. But I finally paid her. And on the last payment I wrote, I said, I could have paid you this a year ago. I knew you didn't need it. But I needed so much to have those 52 good feelings that I got out of knowing that you were getting your money. Never heard from her since. Won't. But you see, if Les Williams is thinking, I mean, I got really indignant with her. And in my head, I got more indignant than that. But because the story was, it didn't matter about her. It mattered about what was happening to me and what I had to do to stay sober. And that was one part of it. And as it turned out, it worked just like it's supposed to. It's so, this is where, you know, we start, this is really where we start the 12 promises that we talk so much about. And there's 147 promises in that big book. And of the 12 that we talk so much about, they do start coming here. They start coming way before that. But all the time you're doing this 9-step work and talking to your sponsor, move on. Don't stop and wait till you get through the 9-step to take the 10th step and the 11th step and the 12th step and then the first one. So get them all in. And when you get through, you'll find it'll be a chain link, just going over and over and over. And as you go, you're supposed to get a little better. I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if I'm as better as I'm going to get. But it's like the man said, and I told you this the first week I was up here, like Jack Nicholson said, and as good as it gets. And he walked into that psychiatrist's office, and he looked at them and said, what if this is the best that it's going to, as good as it's going to get? And I say to you, if this is the best it's going to get, I'll take it, and I will be very happy with it. Thank you so much, and I love each and every one of you. Thank you.